I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to season 3 of On Air. Dan, we're back.
Woo, we're so back, baby.
What happened to your voice while we were away?
I had a bit too much helium. I can't believe how long it's been. It feels like we have not recorded in years.
It's been a while. It's been a minute. But most of all, I have enjoyed over this period, well, thankfully enjoyed many things, and I know you have too, but specifically the influx of direct messages. And I can't even see the shared account that we have at On Air with Dan and Alex on Instagram, but just ones that made their own way to my DMs about how, where are you guys and when are you back and what's happening with the new season? And I mean, we were quite clear that it was, in inverted commas, summer break. And it has, in the grand scheme of things, only been a matter of, are we around 5 weeks or 6 weeks, I want to say? Or is
off?
It a bit longer?
Are you joking?
Actually, it's longer, isn't it?
Yes.
It must be about eight.
It's been 3 months.
No, it hasn't been 3 months.
It has been three months. People are going to be shocked. Okay. But I love how you're like, my favorite thing about being off was seeing how tormented our listeners were.
Yes, it just gave me such delight. You know, it's nice to feel wanted, I guess. That's the takeaway.
I know,
there.
You don't feel that a lot, do you?
Listen, with our listeners, I feel it all the time. So don't start.
And also,
this has been a funny little welcome break from you. I have no idea what you've been... very shady summer plans on your side. I even suspect that we were in Switzerland at the same time at one point, but yes. I don't know how late you were uploading on Instagram.
Well, we were, but you were in Zurich and I was in Geneva, so it's, you know,
not
super
practical.
Where were you?
No, I was not far from Geneva.
No way. Well, anyway, we were busy, so... wait a minute. We were staying right next to each other, but we were still busy.
Well, it's good to be back with you. And hey to everyone. Hello to everyone and all of the listeners. We hope that you are having a great summer, unless you're in the Southern Hemisphere. But we hope you're having a great winter, because we've got listeners from all over the world. But it's great to be back. There is so much that we have thought over the last few weeks when we've been texting each other, oh, we've got to discuss this on the podcast, or that's good for the podcast. And we have made a commitment, haven't we, Dan, where we kind of haven't shared anything with each other so that we can find out what we've been up to firsthand on the episode with all
exactly.
The listeners.
So by the way, welcome to season 3 of On Air, everybody. You'll notice if you're watching on YouTube that there's no video. We should just explain that, because we've decided you don't want to see our little pixelated faces on Zoom. But whenever we can, we're going to gather in a studio. We're going to record awesome in-person video podcasts together. Yeah. But when we're not together, you'll get to at least hear our voices for the weekly episode every Wednesday like normal, right?
And what this does is it takes off that added complexity that we were finding almost weekly, because Dan and I are often on different parts of the earth, let alone the continent. And we, you know, the week comes around super quickly. We can't wait to do the episode. But the complexity of matching time zones, matching calendars, matching availability, finding a quiet spot, finding decent internet, finding a place where we could both be connected uninterrupted for a minimum of an hour and a half, and then adding that of needing decent lighting, needing good camera quality, needing bandwidth to be able to deliver that. That got so difficult. I mean, we didn't really share how difficult that got, but that got so difficult to the point where we thought, hold on, let's go back to basic and remember that what we wanted to share was, you know, the core part of the podcast is our discussion, our news and analysis, our catching up, our listener Q&A, our Am I the A-hole segments, and all of that. And all of that is still going to be delivered to you in crisp, clear audio wherever you get your podcasts. Differences, Dan said, as soon as we are able to be in the same place at the same time, we'll be coming to you live from a decent studio.
Exactly. And, you know, we've been discussing literally for half the summer break. When are we returning? When are we returning? And we've been texting each other, when will it work out? But finally, I saw the universe start to show signs that On Air is coming back, because we, you know, we were working on it, but then the universe said, no, it's going to happen. And it started last week. Yeah, that's right. Okay. We're at the end of this week when I was flying out of Heathrow, and guess where the first On Air sign was? We go to check the gate, and of course, it wouldn't be a new season without one of my first flights being A10.
Oh my God. So one thing that I couldn't wait to get back on the podcast to share with you is, I don't know who from Heathrow Airport gate allocation is listening, but I have never had so many A10s in my life as I have had over the last 2-3 months. It has been constant. I mean, Dan, I have flown on a sector, let's say to Rome, where the first sector of the day for that aircraft was that service. And so, like any crazy type A, you know, detail orientated frequent flyer like us, I'm tracking on flight radar where the aircraft parked the night before on its final sector of the night, knowing that that will be its position overnight while it sleeps and then operates its first flight with me in the morning. And I see it come in and it's parked nicely in the middle, A12. I'm like, okay, that's great. So in the morning, I know that the gate is going to be A12. Oh no. No, no, Heathrow allocation had other plans, because what seemed to happen in the night is the aircraft is towed away from Terminal 5. Not Terminal 5B. Nope, not C. But you know those stands that are next to Terminal 3 by the ATC
the ones
tower?
Yes, I spoke about like years ago.
On where the Virgin Atlantic aircraft park. Oh yeah, so, you know, just a casual 22-minute bus journey.
And you have
know,
to take tunnels to keep us humble and go literally all around Heathrow.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, do I text you about it? I thought, no, I'll let
but,
you know.
But you know
also,
what?
I didn't want you to laugh at me, you know?
I find that so funny, because you are just sadistically saying, oh, I love seeing all these DMs from people missing the podcast. And if that is a listener who is taking out his revenge, dear listener, I encourage you to do that on Alex to your full extent.
Listen,
you know, I frankly think it should be A10 so every time the in the summer. Future. I think his Qatar flights should leave from A10 as well.
Different terminal, Habibi, different terminal.
No, but specifically the ones you're on can be a Terminal 5 flight and then be A10.
Do you remember when QR left from Terminal 5 during the pandemic?
I know, but that was good news for you, right, when they left?
It was... When they left Terminal 5 or when they moved to Terminal 5?
When they left Terminal 5.
When they left Terminal 5, of course, because T5 was so crowded back then, and I can't remember which terminal was still closed at the time. Well, obviously 4.
Oh, I guess 4 was closed, right?
Was 3 also? I feel like 3 maybe. No.
I'm sure 4 was the last one to reopen.
A few people moved into 5. It wasn't just QR. There were some others. And yeah, basically Terminal 5 at that period of time was not great, because you had so many different new operators, and also BA was strangling Qatar's operation in Terminal 5, like keeping them in the corner, giving them only a few desks. The funny thing was, though, is that if you had a first class ticket on Qatar, you had access to the Concorde room, so that was cool.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's, I mean, Terminal 4 is still, I guess, a better experience as a Qatar flyer, right?
Yeah, but before we dwindle off too much, how are you? Where have you been? What have you been up to? The listeners and I are keen to know. And I've got many questions, because I've been watching some videos, but I don't know when they were filmed. Was this pre-summer? Was this over the last few weeks? You went to the Maldives? I saw you on Beyond.
I wasn't in the Maldives, but I did fly them from Dubai to Zurich, which is a fifth, because all their flights to Europe go via Dubai. It's convenient, because getting to or from the Maldives is quite expensive and a pain. So it was easier to review it that way. But I'll just list off where I've been. You can list off where you've been. But I've been to France. I've been to Sweden. I've been to the UAE. I've been to China, Taiwan, Thailand, of course, several times. I've been to Switzerland, and I've been to the UK. That's my little summer list. There's been a lot of flying on some new airlines. I had a really fun review trip around East Asia. So I got to fly
nice.
Xiamen, which you might have seen that video out of Doha.
Yeah.
And that was a very cool kind of sweet spot, because when I learned that when you redeem for business class using Avios on the Qatar code share of that flight, they put you in first class. So I paid business class, but I got to experience one of the most quirky first classes ever.
And there were just so many different loose items, if that makes sense. So many different amenities. I felt like they were scattered along this very long seat area in first.
Yeah. And it is, it's really cool to be in any cabin that's just one row like that.
Yeah.
It feels so exclusive. It's like your own little private plane. And then I also finally got to try Hainan Airlines, China's five-star airline, supposed to be one of the best in the world. And that was also super interesting. Chinese airlines do things so differently than the rest of the world. So it's hard to compare. It's not like apples and apples, you know? But super enjoyable and incredibly affordable flight as well. So yeah, lots of fun flying around, but very busy. You know, the whole idea was we're going to take the summer off. I don't think that ended up materializing for either of us. So now over to you. How has your summer been? How busy has it been?
I mean, there's many things I want to follow up on that, because I want to figure out first where you felt was busy, because you typically traveled to places, and this links with something I want to discuss later in the episode, but you typically were traveling to places that were not the kind of the mainstream or the typical popular summer destinations that are booming in the summer period, right? Like Spain and Italy and Greece and so on. So because you were in so many different parts of the world, and you went to China, you went to Taiwan, you went to Thailand. Thailand isn't always massively popular at this time of year. I feel like it's other parts of the year that it is. How, in a nutshell, do you think, how busy do you have perceived places to have been so far through the summer? Because I've got a few feelings on this.
Good question. Honestly, I haven't thought about it that much, because I haven't been in places I've expected to be busy. The most I would say is London, which is always quite busy. But if you know where to go, it's not crazy. It's funny. What I paid more attention to is the difference in demographics in different times of year. So I spent quite a long time in London in May. And comparing the people who were there then, the tourists who were there then, compared to the tourists who are there now in August, was so different. Like, it's a totally different geographic sort of group that goes in August. So many people from the Gulf right now. It was crazy. Honestly, I mean, Thailand was not super busy this time of year, which it rarely is. China, I haven't been to the places I went before, so it's hard to say. Sweden is literally never busy. It always feels empty. So
But that's nice, and a lot of people are opting for that over the heat. And as I said, we'll come to that in a bit.
To say, sorry, before we get to you.
Yeah.
In my experience, flights this summer,
yes,
very empty.
I don't think it's been busy.
The flights I've taken, very empty.
I think you're right. I share that. I mean, fares I don't think were that high, because I mean, they are typically, when I look back to last year, everything is a bit more than last year. But I just think we have year on year inflation now that airlines take advantage of in following, whether or not that their operational costs are higher than last year is a different story. But definitely fares are, for a few reasons, higher across the board slightly. But in terms of the supply and demand, that usually leaves only the highest fares available. So remember that if you've got an aircraft with 180 seats, then typically, let's say, the last 20 seats are going to be the highest fare. And if those are available, you know, those are the only seats available in the last month, then that's why when you book a month before only, you're going to be left with those high fares. I didn't see that this summer, and I flew a lot and extensively. And I mean, especially in months like August, where you have some of the highest fares of the whole calendar year. And yet when you know that we both use the platform to go in and have a look at how busy flights are and whatever, and so not just personal experience and anecdotes and being on board, but also checking the system, I don't think flights were as busy. And there are a few reasons I've looked into this. Number one, there has been, quote, better summer weather in different markets across the board for a longer period of time that has reduced the urgency and the need for many of those travelers or much of that population to think maybe we don't need to go away. And I'll give you an example. In the UK, the weather has been very good since late April, and it's been pretty consistent on the whole. There have been multiple heat waves, which are torturous when you're in the UK and there's a heat wave because the country is just not designed for it. But the fact is that because that weather has been better, it has reduced the number of people that kind of get home and say, we need to get out of here, and therefore, you know, log on, try and find a holiday and book it and take off. And so that's played a role. The other part is that the boom that we saw after the pandemic, 22, 23, 24, I think that's well and truly now over. We can declare that period finished. There are no more people traveling with vouchers. There are no, you know, bookings that were delayed by a year or two. There is no pent up demand. And so all of that has now gone. So I think just everything has normalized back to 2018, 2019, but I'd say more 2018 levels. And then, of course, the fact that we had in the last few episodes before we took the summer break, the discussions on how, you know, transatlantic travel was down. Americans were saying that they might not be going to Europe as they did because of uncertainty over the economy at home, or they didn't feel that they're in as decent as position financially as last year compared with this year. I feel like that rhetoric very quickly, though, slipped away, actually. And I don't know about you, but I came across hundreds and thousands of Americans having their Europe summer all over Europe this summer. But I guess we have to wait a few more weeks until we see the data.
Yes, but at the same time, I don't know, for example, if you saw Swiss 001 story. I know you met him at the Paris Air Show. Or yeah. Wait, was it Farnborough this year?
It was right? Paris.
Yeah, Paris. Yeah. He was flying the Lufthansa E380 from Munich to Boston, and he posted stories, and I was like, wow, you must be the first to board because it's literally empty. He was like, no, this was in flight. It was completely empty in the section he was sitting in. I'm sure, you know, overall load factors have been good, but just looking, I mean, just based on my data from the flights I've taken, I just looked at the list. There is one flight that I remember out of probably 25 or 30 flights that was sold out. One flight. And, you know, interestingly, I agree with you. The pricing in the summer, it is higher than other times a year. And the flight I took from A10 last week was London Madrid. BA wanted to charge almost $400 per ticket for that flight. So, of course, I'm expecting it to be completely sold out at that price. We get on, and I'd say the load factor was maybe 60%, 70%. So the pricing was just seemed way out of line with what the actual demand was. It wasn't a good indicator. But perhaps the algorithms are getting better and they've decided we'll charge more per ticket, end up making more profit, but we won't fill every seat. I don't know what's going on there.
We'll definitely come back to that topic in a future episode over the coming weeks about the whole kind of dynamic pricing hitting the airline industry and the fact that you may be offered a slightly different fare to me, despite the fact we'll both book at the same time, the same route, you know, maybe just different devices, perhaps even the same internet connection. We'll explore, because that's been quite a big story in the US. But you're right. I don't think that it has been as crazy busy summer. I don't think there's been, we haven't seen the footage of the lines, and that I think air traffic control on the whole has been pretty smooth. There hasn't been, you know,
not if you ask O'Leary.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there have been a few days of French ATC, you know, shortages that mean that there have been limitations on flights that operate across France, but it hasn't appeared to have been as bad as previous years.
You're right.
Unless you ask Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, but we'll again, we have to wait a few more weeks to get that data. Like you, I went to France and also to Switzerland and to Italy, Greece, and a couple of other places, Ibiza and the Middle East briefly. The part I want to talk about in Italy is something that I saw, that just this trend, which is that really people are going to have to start changing the way that you travel, either in summer or that you treat a city. And I say that with this: Rome is an incredible city in Europe. It's probably my favorite city in Europe. And wow, the part that you associate with Rome, apart from the beautiful food, the great atmosphere, is that it's literally an outdoor open air museum, right? When you're walking around. Have you been extensively?
Yeah, it was the first trip Oscar and I ever took together back in 2015, and have not been back since.
You have to go back. I mean, I've been 20 times and it's not enough. I can easily just keep going and going. However, when you tie what you typically do in Rome, which is basically, you know, 25,000 steps. I mean, from the moment you arrive, it's just walking and walking and walking and walking, because you're naturally not even specifically maybe setting out to go to a specific site, but you're just coming across, you know, ancient artifacts, and you're coming across museums, and you're coming across just the beautiful history and ruins of Rome, combined with, as I said, an excellent food scene, great places to snack, amazing places for lunch and dinner and so on. All of that is not compatible with 40 plus degrees Celsius heat. Yeah. And that is what Rome has endured for so long, including while I was there. That's very difficult. I mean, that is a complete kind of game changer in how you go about your trip. Because, so for example, there for 4 days, and for the 4 days, the temperature was above 43 degrees. An extremely strong sun of 43 degrees. What do in the day? Because you're in the city. Most city hotels don't have pools, so you can't just chill in the pool all day. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you're walking around, you're doing everything I just described. That is impossible in that heat. I mean, the sun is burning. It's the equivalent of walking around in the Middle East, in the Gulf, right now at 12 noon, which is just something you wouldn't do, because you would be stupid if you did that, because it's nearly 50 degrees. Yeah. So that's what it was like in Rome. Difference is, in Rome, do you have restaurants with decent air conditioning? Of course not. These are all listed old buildings that are, you have alfresco dining outside. You can't sit outside because it's so hot. And it is just, I feel like this is becoming a problem everywhere now, where you're worried about how decent the AC is going to be. The places that we could even consider to eat during the day in the middle of the heat were so limited, because we're trying to think up places that have got decent AC and the door shut, and Rome doesn't function that way, understandably so. That's the beauty of Rome. You're outdoors. So that was quite difficult. And then I just feel like this trend is something that I've started to notice, and it's not just me, it's in all of the papers, the Financial Times, the Bloomberg, they've all done deep dives on how it's time for Europe to get real on AC now, because, you know, just popping to Rome in July and having 4 days of 45 degrees C is going to make for a pretty difficult trip.
Yeah, I've read about that too, and how there was some article right about how many deaths are being caused in Europe every year by the refusal to embrace AC, which I thought was interesting. But you're so right about Europe is not built for these types of temperatures. The Middle East, Southeast Asia, they're built around it being hot all the time, which results in, similar to what you have in many parts of the US, mall culture. In the Middle East and Southeast Asia, it's all about malls. That is the opposite of what most of Europe is about. It's about walking around outdoors.
That's the beauty of Europe, is that it's not mall culture. I mean, that's what we love to soak up. And the fact that, you know, as I said, I'm standing there trying to figure out where can you think of a restaurant? I mean, I could only really think of restaurants that will be in massive grand hotels that would probably have, you know, the full AC and all of that, but not my list in Rome of the charming little family run, you know, cacio e pepe delicacies dotted around the city. Those were sweat boxes. That was not comfortable for anyone. Combine that with the proximity to the oven and the heat, and you quickly begin to realize, okay, that's not good news.
Yeah, it is tough. I'm sure you have so many stories as well. This just makes me think of another. I have like written down these stupid, completely valueless stories I wanted to tell you from the past week, because I had another sign that Honor was coming back. And that is, speaking of heat and specifically in the Middle East, the topic of bus gates is something we love to bring up, right? Mm-hmm. And it's clear I have some kind of curse in Doha, because I posted on my stories from when I was doing the Xiamen trip that I got a bus gate on arrival and on departure.
Yeah, well, you need to speak to Xiamen about that, because that's everything to do with what the airline is paying.
So I landed in Doha this time. So I flew London, Madrid, Madrid, Doha.
You just sounded really southern, by the way.
What, southern? Like Texas?
You were like, well,
I landed in Doha.
sorry, I get interrupted. Go on.
So I landed in Doha from Madrid, got a bus gate. Wasn't surprised because I was on Iberia. Of course, Iberia is going to get a bus gate. That's expected. The next day I was connecting on Qatar, and that's where I was really curious. I was like, will this finally break my curse of bus gates in 45 degree heat? I was waiting. We get to the airport in the morning, and lo and behold, we have a regular gate, A5. So we go there. We're so excited to not have to go out into the heat. Boarding time passes. We sit there. We wait. We're chatting to some people. Finally, departure time is coming up, and we're still not on board. And I'm going, what is going on? And they make an announcement, and we're talking to some people, and you know, when you're talking to someone, you want to be polite and you don't just want to be like, shh, we need to listen to the announcement. So I was listening with one ear, and I hear them say, unfortunately, there's a technical problem with the aircraft. So there's been an aircraft swap. You'll now be departing from gate C93. And I was like, this is Alex. He's been manifesting this. This means On Air is coming back very soon. And then I had to go to gate C93, and we had another bus. So.
I don't even know where that is.
Exactly.
Who am I kidding? I was in the control room with my friends, you know, saying, oh, send him to C93. That sounds far.
Yes,
that sounds like
literally.
It's in Bahrain.
It was one of those gates that's, you know, basically in downtown Doha.
So. That's funny. That's good. When you were in Scandinavia, were you only in Sweden, or did you go to a few other places?
Let me think. We were only in Sweden, but we were all over Sweden. We went to the very south. We went to the very north. We got to stay in this crazy Maldives-style hotel with overwater villas on a river in the north, which was also super cool. But my goodness, okay, so here's an interesting aviation angle to all this. We had a guide one day, and he was telling us how last night his cousin's wife, who he was close to them, she had a stroke, but because they live up there, there's no hospital nearby.
Oh, wow.
So they had to send a medical evacuation aircraft to fly her to, I think, Stockholm to get treatment. But of course, when it comes to strokes, it's so time sensitive. Every minute counts to prevent, you know, more brain damage.
Such an emergency.
So they have to drive 2 hours to the nearest basically tiny little runway, because I think the Swedish air ambulance service only flies Pilatus planes, so they're tiny anyway. They drive 2 hours there in an ambulance, then they need to fly for almost an hour to Stockholm and then drive to the hospital. And it's amazing that in Sweden, this is provided for free. You get these air ambulance services as part of the public national health care. So, I mean, thank goodness they didn't have to worry about that. But the tragic part of this story is that she ended up passing away due to the stroke. And it just puts, you know, this the importance of connectivity into perspective. How it's literally a danger to live far. I mean, this is, you know, my thinking immediately. Yeah, to live far from an airport can truly be a difference of life or death.
Well, when you're, you know, there's living far from an airport, but you're in a country that's mostly urban, and then there's living far and remote, you know, from an airport and living, because how close is the closest city to where they were? Never mind, you know, an airport. It's a thing. That actually is something that has always fascinated me, is the people that completely live, I don't literally mean live off the grid and in that they don't have internet, they don't have electricity, but I mean live off the grid in that they have all of that, but they just live so remote and on the whole are fine and content with that. And yet we, just through upbringing and through the lives that we have lived, would maybe stay there for 4 days and be thinking, you know, God, I hope in those 4 days you don't need X, Y, or Z.
Literally, because of,
and you think, hold on, these people are here all the time. They're, they're, you know, that this is how they live, and they don't know any different.
Yeah, it's so true. And here I am on every episode of On Air pretty much complaining about growing up in Gothenburg, which, you know, when I get that perspective of someone who lives, like, I guess they lived 3 or 4 hours from the commercial airport in that region, which only has flights to Stockholm. That puts everything into perspective of me being like, okay, well, I am at least grateful that Gothenburg has flights to all over Europe multiple times a day. So there's definitely levels of connectivity that, you know, all connectivity is good connectivity.
You're right. And that's also part of the reason why we absolutely love aviation, isn't it? Because it does make the world a smaller place. And it is great to be able to jump from, think about how different Italian culture is to Greek culture. They're two amazing Mediterranean cultures, and yet they're so different. And they're just an hour apart by flight. You know, I flew this summer from Rome into Athens. And the fact that the flight is just over 1 hour and a few minutes, for me, I understand how either Americans who live in Middle America or people that live in Australia, and I don't just mean Melbourne and Sydney, but maybe places that are a bit more remote, I get that big reaction sometimes in when you talk to them, and when they discuss how, when you look at Europe and France is, you know, totally different ball game and place to Italy, and it's less than an hour away, and then Italy is so different to, for example, Greece, and it's just an hour away, and so in that sense, I feel like you really come to value that when you take time off, or you're with family, or you're vacationing or holidaying in summer, because to be able to jump from one to the other with fares that are very low, with air travel that is increasingly affordable, with competition that is everywhere, is something that we as a society are blessed with, and I think take for granted, because it wasn't always like that. And hopefully, you know, long may that continue. That plus the fact that a certain low-cost carrier is having its moment this summer, because like you and myself, and I'm sure every listener will know, that apparently this wasn't just a summer where On Air were on a break, but this was a Jet2 summer. This was a Jet2 holiday summer, where apparently nothing beats a Jet2 holiday. Dan and I have got several reservations with such a claim, but how weird for Jet2, you know, this UK Leeds born carrier, to have its moment so globally this summer, where last year's summer, I think, was the Brat one by Dua Lipa. Was it Dua Lipa?
Oh,
it wasn't Dua Lipa. God. Oh my God. It wasn't, was it?
Charlie XCX.
Charlie XCX. I always get them confused. Okay. So where this, who could have bet money that terrible advert about, you know, that's £200 off for a family of four, because apparently you need it to be explained what £50 per person is off. Who would have thought that would have gone so viral and just everywhere? You know, Americans using it to narrate their TikTok videos. You know, have you had the Thai version? The Thai version.
Yes,
Vietnamese.
I've heard them all.
Yeah.
Can we just appreciate that still, I'm sure 90 to 95% of people who have heard that sound have no idea that Jet 2 is actually an airline. It's like they know it's a Jet 2 holiday is a thing, but the number of people I've seen realize like, oh wait, that's actually an airline? But to us, we've known Jet 2 all along, baby.
I mean, before it was cool. You know, I didn't want to draw attention to it, but I mean, there would be, you know, many times where we deliberately left out any discussion of Jet 2 because we were thinking, no, this is too small for our big global audience at On Air. We can't mention what's happening in Jet 2. How wrong were we? Drake. There's this weird picture of Drake on Instagram on his own feed where he appears to be in Jet 2 Holidays headquarters in like an office with no staff. Have you seen it?
No.
I'm going to send it to you, right? Basically, Drake is standing there. Let me open up his Instagram now, and I'm going to get it. And for anyone else who's got their phone handy, have a look. So his Instagram username is Champagne Puppy. And scroll down a little bit. There we go. It's on August 1st. And he put as the caption, from Jet 2 to 2 Jets, you must have mad. I think as in you must be mad. And it's him standing in some awful, you know, kind of, when I say awful, kind of typical bad office of Jet 2 Holidays. What was Drake doing in there? I'm just sending it to you now so you can see it, because I know with your restrictions, you have to breathe your way into Instagram, don't you? And we can't be having you do that while we're recording. Okay, there you go. I've just sent it to you. Have a look. What's the deal here? Why is Drake in the Jet 2 HQ?
# Mental Health Awareness Week.
Yeah, well, he didn't put that as Jet 2, no. But so that was weird. The other part is that it's mentioned everywhere, and people are trying to have what they call a Jet 2 summer or a Jet 2 holiday summer. Then I started to think, okay, it went so viral. This, for me, was clear evidence that, you know, once that horse has bolted, there's not much. I started to wonder in the early weeks why Jet 2 wasn't seemingly cashing in or celebrating how viral it had gone as much. When you went to their Instagram, there was barely any mention across Jet 2 social media of, you know, nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. They were not reposting things. They were not acknowledging how viral they had gone. And I do think it's because perhaps they were secretly worried as to what would happen next. And then it did two things. Firstly, it quickly became the narrated sound and jingle and whatever for any fail. Video. Yeah, any travel fail. So like someone caught in a 3-hour queue at immigration and it was nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. You know, like a wave of cancelled flights, you know, a fight on board. So many fight on board videos of Ryanair flights of drunks, you know, fist fighting. And the song was nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday, despite it being Ryanair. Then the Trump administration use it as the music for a deportation video, which then, whoa, you're massively now going into different territory here, where you're talking about a very hard line, you know, policy that is being questioned in the US courts over their deportations, and you've got Jet 2 narrating it. That's a disaster for them, and I'm sure nothing that, you know, when they created this up in Leeds or wherever, they ever thought that it would be used on the ICE videos in the US. So
would you say that overall this has been a positive branding exercise for Jet 2 or a negative one because of the fact that it's been mostly associated with fails?
I think that for the first week of it being everywhere, it was good, and then I think it has just since declined, you know, and just got worse and worse. The travel fails, and then the Trump admin stuff, and then it's just used in the fights on board, the diversions, you know, it's used for, you know, emergency landings or, you know, these routine slightly negative things that happen all the time. It's become the song of that. So I think, you know, on the whole, it's been pretty negative over the last part of the virality of this bloody Jet 2 stuff.
Yeah. But I wonder if for the demographic that was originally looking at a Jet 2 holiday, if this has had any difference. Because I've never been on a Jet 2 holiday. My impression is always that,
why obviously,
you know, there's EasyJet. Let's just brush over that. There's EasyJet, there's a Jet 2 holidays. That's sort of in line with like what would be a Ryanair holiday, right? It's not, you're going for cheap sunshine.
No, that's
you're not looking
true.
For luxury,
On the whole, most Jet 2 holidays are very affordable sunshine. Yeah, you're right. But they do have very decent, like anything, they offer a whole variety. So there is a portfolio that are the more high end, the 5-star. And but on the whole, yeah, that's not their target market. Their target demographic isn't the premium leisure traveler. It is more the wider masses and the more affordable sunshine. But I don't think it would be fair to say that it's, oh, that's a Ryanair holiday, because I think that would be maybe their lower end of the scale is that category. But the rest of it is kind of very middle ground and the same kind of demographic that would perhaps book an EasyJet holiday. But EasyJet holidays didn't go viral, but EasyJet do have a holiday division. British Airways have a holiday division. BA Holidays, that's how you know that is now the way BA wants you to earn tier points and be able to progress to the next tier in that big sudden changes that they introduced earlier this year. Funny enough, I had lunch with someone a few weeks ago, and she said to me, BA Holidays. She said, that's an oxymoron. It's not. There's, the fact you can't put BA and holidays in one phrase together.
Yep,
she said, because
I agree.
It's just not a thing. So I didn't take her opinion on a Jet 2 holiday, but I should have actually. That was a missed opportunity.
I know. One more thing that we need to tie back to last season. Yeah. Guys, this is a very catch-up episode. Next week, we're going to discuss more news. Don't worry. Yeah. But I don't want to even say we. I had the genius idea.
No, it was we.
No, guys, go back to last season. Listen to Alex's idea and then listen to mine and see which is coming to fruition. Because
no, your idea was not about Aegean. Your idea was about Athens. And then we spoke of Aegean.
A different airline using A321 at Lars.
But then
and
we had a joint discussion. Okay, go on. Explain.
So basically, to catch you up, in case you didn't listen to that, we were discussing our airline ideas. If we had to start one airline right now, where would we do it and what would the business model be? And I said my idea is to start an airline based in Athens operating A321LRs and XLRs to be able to basically function as the Middle Eastern airlines do, but in the European Union. I said that I'm sure there would be a lot of appeal for an airline like that in Europe and Greece. Is a destination in and of itself. So
that led us to that then discussion that followed that on Aegean, right? And we were wondering why Aegean wasn't adventurous enough. Why hadn't Aegean introduced A321 XLR to be able to leverage the Athens hub for all of the reasons you just described, right?
Yep, exactly.
And so we're going through what, Aegean need to reinvest. They're very profitable. They play it too safe. They need to be able to order. We said, for example, why don't they just order, a few A321 XLR in order to be able to tap into markets like India. We specifically said this, right?
Yes, which we should say, it's really not a risky thing for them to do.
No.
Qantas has ordered these aircraft and are using them domestically. They're not even using them for the point they're made for. So for them to order those aircraft would just give them a lot more choice. It's not like they'd be, ordering an A330 or an A350.
Yeah. And so because the economics of the 321 XLR are so decent and you're able to operate with very little financial risk and the margins are better and all of this that we had explained on that episode, we had not simply outlined that Aegean should be more adventurous. We had also, as I said, stated they should take the 321 XLR. We'd even provided destinations like India. We explained why it would work. We explained, the type of models that they could follow. We explained how they could, transit and so on. So we went through all of this. Then what happened?
Well, Aegean listened to On Air and they said, great idea, we're going to do that, or something along those lines, right?
Yeah, so Aegean then end up placing an order for just two A321 XLR aircraft in opening and admitting it would be the first time that Aegean would now enter the world of long haul, and they would be doing it safely using the A321XLR. And I say safely, I don't just mean literally safely, but I mean in terms of mitigating their financial risk. And they would be doing it with decent economics on the aircraft that we had chosen. And they said, yeah, we'll be sending this aircraft to India. So we see this announcement. And firstly, I wondered why we were not invited to the ceremony, because they had a little ceremony to announce this, right?
Yep.
Secondly, I'm wondering who at Aegean is listening and didn't, you know, flag us in a message that that's a great idea, guys. Let me just take this to the board, because
I mean, where's our credit? Yeah, you know,
credit.
The amount of
where
ways we
commission?
Have influenced airlines. Yeah, Airbus. Hello, where is our commission?
So with the two A321 XLRs, Aegean is going to launch five weekly Athens-Delhi flights from March in 2026, and then three weekly Athens-Mumbai flights from May. The aircraft is also going to have 24 lie-flat business class suites, something we also mentioned in the same episode about how that kind of aircraft would give you a solid foundation to be able to have a dedicated real business class. Just a few rows, we said, something lie flat. And before you know it, you have a nice, you know, economically agile, easy, very efficient long haul branch of what is a very well established Greek airline, Aegean. And
exactly. Yeah. And we cannot wait. We will be very excited to try it. The interesting detail here is, these are former, or not former, but these are A321 XLRs that were supposed to go to JetBlue. So we already know what the cabins will look like. It's 24 JetBlue mint seats. The colors JetBlue uses are shocker blue, which matches Aegean. It's what we were saying. So add some Mediterranean vibes in here and it will be perfect. It's a lovely, comfortable seat with a door.
Yeah.
This is just such exciting news. I wish they had ordered 40 instead of four, but it's a start.
Yeah, no, it's but what, it wasn't four, it was two.
No, wait, how did I get that wrong? Two, right, two XLRs, and then they have four A321 LRs on order as well.
Exactly. The A321 LRs are not going to be, or as far as we know, are not the this is not Aegean unlocking their long haul area. The long haulness of the network, if you like, is coming as a result of the 321 XLR, which, as you said, were destined for JetBlue. I flew Aegean this summer. Really good. I just think that's so. It's commendable, the little extras that they do, that they have kept up, that other airlines have scrapped. You know, it feels very Greek from the moment that you board. You have beautiful Greek hospitality. Every passenger immediately is offered the suites for takeoff. You know, it's as it used to be in the golden age, because your ears pop. So it's decent to have a suite in that moment. You have the in-flight entertainment, not seat back, because this is not the US, but you have the option to be able to connect to Aegean's onboard Wi-Fi and also stream using their own service some of the movies and TV shows that they load on. You also have an in-flight map built into that, so you can view the map on your own device, which is nice, especially when it's just an hour flight. As I said, I was doing from Rome to Athens. You know, it was on a nice, clean, new A321neo and beautiful Greek yogurt and food for all. And that's something that Aegean has also kept up. So it's they're a really decent European carrier that you know Lufthansa need to stay well away from, because they
Please.
You know, those are all those little extras I said are the first things Lufthansa puts in the bin. That's just how it works when the Lufthansa group gets hold of it. Which actually brings me to quickly discuss with you how Turkish Airlines and the stake with Air Europa.
Everything, because we have one more topic that's also related to Lufthansa Group, but yes. Yeah. Well, first of all, let's say how this is related to Lufthansa Group. How about that?
Yeah. So Air Europa has been up for grabs for quite a while. All of the airline groups are circling. Turkish Airlines has not been a front runner in these discussions, and it hasn't been widely reported that they were even interested. But they have acquired an Air Europa stake for 300 million euros in a way to strengthen its presence in Europe. They can't have the majority stake because Air Europa is a European carrier, but this is between a 26 and 27% stake is something that will be mutually beneficial for both. And I also like the fact that it just introduces a different player in investment in aviation than it ending up with either IAG, even Air France KLM, or a Lufthansa, because it protects consumers from the dwindling state of competitive play in European air travel.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. It's, first of all, thank goodness Lufthansa Group stayed away. Thank goodness IAG stayed away, because we don't want Iberia and Air Europa being the same company. Air France KLM would have been interesting because they're still a group that, you know, has a bit of growing to do to be the size of the other two groups.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see how this all plays out. The other thing that we have to have a good laugh at when it comes to Lufthansa Group is, of course, the ever-evolving comedy show that is the Allegris rollout, whether it's business class, whether it's first class, yeah, and whether it's Lufthansa or one of the other group airlines. And in this case, Swiss, which is introducing the same product in business and first, has decided that it's going to market the first class a little differently. They want to take a new approach to marketing first class, and specifically these center seats, right, that are a hybrid one-person/two-person seat. Tell us more.
So Swiss are taking delivery of the same seats, as you said, and this is going to debut on their A350, which is set to be delivered over the coming months. I actually saw a couple of their Airbus A350s while I was at the Airbus factory last week in Toulouse, where I was there for a delivery. And the Allegris seats, something that you have flown, I still haven't flown it yet. So it's going to be a copy, like for like, configuration as to what, for example, Lufthansa have on their 350, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so with that, rather than, you know, acknowledging that Lufthansa has made a complete mess of how they market, you've got a business class seats with so many different types of seats, you know, not one seat is equal to the other, and you have to pay more or less for this, and some have got this level of privacy, some have got that level of privacy, some are double, some are single, some of them are considered a window, but they're not fully a window because I can't even keep up. And I haven't bothered to try to keep up either because, frankly, Lufthansa can't. So if they can't, it's not up to me to figure it out, right? And what's funny is Swiss is trying to, you know, with its Swissness that it likes to protect, it's trying to say, as is not that, as is something a little more elevated, introducing what they are calling a grand suite in first class. So I got the email, Swiss are introducing a grand suite in first class, a first in first class, a new evolution. First things first, Swiss need a better digital media, I mean, capability. The photos and the renderings were just unclear, and it was all very vague. But on the whole, I mean, you describe it because you've flown it. So just explain what exists now on Lufthansa. And that's what Swiss are going to get, but then how Swiss are going to rebrand it.
So picture this. There's a wide seat in the middle that is made for one person because it has one TV, one tray table, one storage compartment, but right, two people can sit there if they want, and two people can book it. So if you're a couple or you're close friends or family or whatever, and you want to sit together in the center seat, you can do that. The crazy thing is that you don't actually get a discount, even though you're sharing one seat that is not close to equivalent of two separate seats. You still have to pay full price for two people.
And so just pause there for a minute, because the seat is designed in its features for one seat. So, for example, there is one TV screen. There is one of everything in that center suite, right?
Exactly. One of everything, besides the fact that the seat is split down the middle, so one side can technically recline without the other doing it, but it's you're going to need to do everything together at the exact same time with your companion if you want to sit there. So the pricing is just completely nonsensical, and the feedback has been terrible to it. So Swiss is taking this up a notch by saying that, hey, you don't only need to be two people. How about three people flying together in a first class grand suite, as they're calling it? So what is that? Well, in all of these new first class products, so the Emirates Game Changer as well, which isn't so new, but it's the new type of model where there's, in Lufthansa's case, 3/4 seats per row, depending on how you consider it. On Emirates, there's three. That means each seat exits to the aisle on only one side, right? So on one aisle, there will be two seats exiting to that aisle. On the other aisle, there will only be one seat that exits there. So in this case, with the alpha seats toward the left side of the aircraft, Swiss has said, since you share an aisle with the window seat and the center seat here, it's actually a three-person suite, which literally makes no sense, because you can apply that logic to any cabin that shares an aisle. You could go to business class, you could go to Q suite and say, hey, we now have a 8-person suite just because we have the suite in the middle and then we have seats on the side along the windows. These are separate seats.
Eight of you are traveling, right?
Exactly.
So if you know the eight people, so that's what they're marketing as. They're saying, hey, you buy the window suite and you buy the center seat, and actually this is a grand first class suite with your own aisle. No, it's not. You just know the person.
So if you think, we can actually compare it to a hotel. It might be easier to sort of make this analogy if you book one suite at a hotel and then you book one basic classic room that interconnects with the suite, that doesn't suddenly make it a grand suite or a presidential suite. It makes it a suite with an interconnecting room. That's the same thing here. You can't just call it something else. And if you're going to do that, at least give us a good, you know, bundle price for three people to buy all those, this grand suite at a discount. But no, all three people still have to pay the same price per person. There's no discount. So it's just such a wild marketing tactic that adds to the chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how they thought this was a good idea.
The icing on the cake is you can only book it by calling in 2025. So that we'll leave you with that to scratch your heads about.
Yeah, that's a good one. The other part is, I was thinking, okay, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They say you book the middle suite, which has an occupancy maximum of two, but you still have to book as two separate tickets, or not two separate tickets, two separate passengers, even though you're doing them a favor by keeping a whole suite free, because you said, don't worry, I'll jump in with the other person. So that's nonsensical. So let's say you've got that middle one, and then you've got the solo suite by the window, and that's what they're marketing as this grand first class suite. So then I thought about the aisle. Okay, you know, the stranger on the other side of the aircraft, so the person who is in the 1K suite, solo suite, is that person able to walk through the galley and round and up the aisle of where you and your companions have this grand suite? Yes, because it's not
technically
private.
They would have no reason to, but the bigger question I have is, the crew will be walking through that aisle inevitably. They might say, okay, we'll choose to do the right aisle, the past the kilo seat instead, because this is now a grand suite. But inevitably, some people will walk through there. If not, you know, during the flight, during boarding, people might board through there or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just, it's lunacy.
And we expected a bit more, you know, pragmatic, cool, sharper approach from Swiss, who could have perhaps distanced themselves from the Allegris chaos. But they've topped it here with their own version of it, which is not even to do with what Lufthansa have done. So yeah, a bit questionable. We'll stay across it and we'll see how that goes with it. And the delivery of that is coming up in the coming months. I want to jump quickly before we wrap on, you were telling me about where you were in Sweden and you were saying that you were very remote. Have you noticed more travelers to places like Sweden or in your travels around Scandinavia who are just searching for cooler climates in what everyone is calling coolcations, which is basically the big travel trend of this summer that has shifted, where people are searching for cooler climates because Europe is just so hot. So those climates that typically have cooler weather and fresher air have seen a surge in visitor numbers, and the traditional summer hotspots are kind of steady, if not slightly down year on year, probably because of the impact of wildfires, of extended levels of heat, of the lack of AC, of everything that we just described.
Yeah, well, yes, in one way. I think when you talk to tourists in Scandinavia, a lot of them give that as a reason. Either they wanted to go somewhere cooler or they're just interested in northerly tourism. They're interested in seeing the midnight sun or, you know, hiking, those types of things. And I have to say that those types of tourists, the tourists that do make it to Sweden, let alone northern Sweden, are really cool tourists. They're usually quite, you know, respectful of the place they're in, of That's nature. Nice. Yeah. So it's a more elevated premium type of tourism, which I think is great. It's exactly what Sweden and Norway are going for. So yeah, different crowd. I don't think we've seen a change in the type of demographic or a widening of the type of demographic who come to Sweden yet.
But don't you think that's because it's so vast? I mean, you don't come across anyone, do you, when you're in the remote areas?
or there's very few places outside of Stockholm that are like tourism hubs where, you know, if you went to interview people outside the Louvre, then yeah, you would be able to get a lot of data very quickly on why people are there and stuff. Yeah. So I guess you're right about that point.
The other quick trend, again, over the last few months, and I've taken this from a New York Times article that I read and have since been discussing this in a forum, is that many travelers are trying to buy something that is becoming increasingly rare or difficult to find when traveling. And that is the usual travel experiences that they want, but paired with quietness. The ability to be able to go back to either a hotel room, an Airbnb, an apartment, and genuinely have quietness, you know, stillness, is becoming slightly difficult in many places that now just have increasing visitor numbers year on year. And it's so important because now, I mean, when you're checking places to where you're checking where you might stay and you're checking the reviews, you know, yes, you look at what it looks like and you're checking if it's clean and if it meets your expectations in so many different areas. But also, are you not like me thinking, but what about the street that it's on? What if it echoes because it's, you know, these are high buildings and it's a busy street below and the sound's going to bounce up in the middle of the night. So it only takes one person to shout at the end of the street and then you're awake and there's not double glazing because it's an old building and, you know, or is the AC going to keep up? There's so many considerations, but the quietness thing and how it's becoming just more and more difficult led to the fact that people started to say, what if we go somewhere remote? What if we do go to Sweden? What if we do go to a national park? What if we avoid, you know, Paris, Madrid, Barcelona, Rome?
Yeah, I mean, it's the noise and especially the crowds. Just people want to be, you know, at the Colosseum alone, which is very hard. It's getting harder and harder for money or anything, any time of year even, to get away from the crowds in the places that people want to go, which is pushing people to more off the beaten path places, which is great because it spreads out the crowds. But yeah, I think there's a lot of catching up to do for different countries in terms of trying to balance tourism revenue with destroying the local environment for the locals. And we've seen protests all over Europe again this summer in places like Barcelona, people just saying their cities are being ruined by tourism. And it seems like however expensive hotels get, if you just look at London, how insane the hotel prices are there, people are still going to go. So it's almost like cost needs to be so astronomical to the point where it starts discouraging people. But then that's horrible if you get to that point. So I don't know what to do. We need tourism agencies marketing more, you know, secondary cities or off the beaten path places.
Well, it's funny,
for people to go.
You know, the thankfully the most relaxed part of the summer for me is in Greece, and you know, it's complete disconnect. I think I told you it's genuinely maybe the only time that I feel that okay, yeah, everything is like time to relax and to chill and to let go of, for example, a news agenda or let go of headlines. Or we were texting a few times, and you said to me, "Oh, have you kept up with blah blah blah?" And I said to you, Dan, I know nothing about it because I've made a conscious choice to make sure that I did not fill my head with it. Instead, I read fiction. I read, you know, just to try to, and it works. But what's funny is when I talk about Greece, some people respond with, "But isn't it, you know, full of Americans and really busy in the summer?" And I'm not in Santorini or Mykonos. I'm not in the only two places that, and that's it. I encourage everyone, go out. There are hundreds of islands. Go and find somewhere beautiful and tranquil where you're alone and you have authentic food rather than commercial food, where you have local brands rather than the commercial brands, where you've got untouched and unspoiled areas, not just the two places that, for example, the US have heard of, and that's it.
Exactly. So, yeah, Mykonos, Santorini. That's what to avoid,
wouldn't
right?
Recommend, yeah, not in summer anyway. Not in summer. Well, look, it's just like old times. It's like we never left. That's how
it really
kills.
Is. It's crazy.
It's good to catch up with you. And we will be back on the news agenda and with a few new segments as well that we're going to be introducing for season 3 that we will share more details of in the next episode, as well as a couple of other little aspects that we want you to look out for over the coming season. And we are also open, as always, to your questions. Your new season 3 questions can reach us directly on our Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex.
Yes, please send those over. We're going to do a bunch of Q&A next week, as well as talking about the news. We cannot wait to see you then, and welcome back. Thanks
for being
sticking
with us,
with
guys.
Us.
Yes. See you next week.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on pristine exterior paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save.